Hi there, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. We're here to have conversations about living with spinal muscular atrophy. Throughout this podcast, we will be covering lots of different topics, from preparing for university, getting the most from your personal budget, sex and relationships, and lots more. So we invite different hosts from across the SMA community to come together here. We want to answer your questions, provide you with useful tips and recommendations, and also share personal stories. So please do reach out and connect with us here at the charity SMA UK. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find the podcast useful. Hello everyone, and welcome to today's SMA UK podcast. Obviously, you've hopefully seen there's been quite a few videos on social media where we've had people talking a bit about experiences, and we decided to mix things up a little bit. So we're going to be focusing on SMA type 4, which is something that I'm personally not as well versed in. So I'm going to learn something more today, which is always good. And we're going to be joined by Peter Hartley, who's going to be sharing his experience of having SMA type 4. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Where in the country are you?
Shropshire.
Well, I'm over in Cambridgeshire. So it's the joys of technology are bringing us from Shropshire to Cambridgeshire without the long drive. So, and obviously with lockdown and COVID, it's doubly useful having these technology options to be able to connect like this. So yeah, really, Peter, as I said before, really excited to talk with you and hear a bit about your experience, your story. And I think, you know, for those that haven't maybe come across the SMA type 4 as much, definitely lots of things to learn. So it would be great if you could just kick us off, Pete, with a bit about you, whatever you care to share. Just be nice to hear a bit generally about you, really.
Well, I'm actually now 70 years old. And for most of my life, I was a maths teacher.
Okay.
This is totally without any disability, of course. It wasn't till quite late that I became disabled.
Yeah, which I sort of, without, as I said a couple of times already, knowing much about SMA type 4, I sort of understood that there is a period of life where, all intents and purposes, you're not with a disability or a health condition. So what sort of age were you when you started to notice, that things weren't as they previously were?
I think I first started when I was actually 45.
Right.
That would be in 1995. But from what I understand, people can get adult onset SMA quite early, in their 20s and 30s.
Mm.
But I never got any sign really until I was 45, when I started developing a limp in my right leg.
Okay, so that was the first sign of something changing, was that your right leg was a bit weaker and there was a bit of a limp,
Yeah, I went to the GP with it, and he diagnosed sciatic nerve problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all livable with. You see, that's the trouble with SMA type 4. You can live with it for long, long periods.
And so from being 45 with the limp, I mean, was there, you sort of mentioned the GP. So how long was it until you got the SMA diagnosis?
Well, between 45 and 50.
Right, so over about 5 years, wow.
Things definitely started to turn worse.
Yeah.
And I was out delivering Christmas cards, actually. And I suddenly realised that I really couldn't walk at all.
Mm.
You know, it was just too much. And then I discovered when I got home, I tried some tests, like, can I stand on my toes, tiptoe, and found that, no, it was impossible.
Right.
So I then went to the doctor again. I think it was late in 1999. And she did the usual hammer on the knee test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know whether you've seen that.
Yeah, it's like, I've seen it in the movies, yeah.
Yeah, in the movies. they hit your knee, and she felt for the sensation in the ankle. Mm. And she basically said, I can feel nothing. So she referred me to the physiotherapy at the doctor's surgery, and she said about the same. There doesn't appear to be any signal going down to your foot.
Wow. And that must have been just back one step in terms of those 5 years where, you know, you started to limp. But obviously, I'd imagine over the 5 years, it wasn't that you suddenly then woke up and then that day delivering Christmas cards, you couldn't really walk at all. There must have been a sort of ongoing weakening,
yes,
that led to that. I mean, that must have been quite frustrating and scary to know that it wasn't right, but to just be told that it was a sciatica.
Well, I didn't feel really scared at all.
Okay.
My right leg clearly was slightly withered, if that's the right word. Mm. It had obviously lost muscle tone. But after the physiotherapist visit, I was referred to the hospital. Mm-hmm. In Telford. And basically, when I went there, they did all the tests again. And the person said, I think we know what this is, but I better get the consultant in. Because mm-hmm. quite often you don't see a consultant, you see one of his minions.
Yeah.
And they basically said, we think we know what it is, but we'll have to do more tests. So it was the first visit to the hospital, a diagnosis.
Mm. And at that point, was there any, sort of just wondering how you felt emotionally? Were you then, was there a fear of that it was actually not sciatica, it was something else, or did you sort of just keep taking it a step at a time?
Well, a step at a time, basically. I mean, I had lots of blood tests. I went back to the GP, and she said they seem to be testing it for everything.
Yeah.
You know, for cancers, goodness knows what.
Mm.
But, of course, they all came back clear.
Right. So when they said they thought they knew what it was and they spoke to the consultant, was that at that point when you mentioned it, was that SMA they then were thinking it was, or was it something else that they thought it was?
No, they thought, they didn't tell me at the time, but yeah, they told the GP they thought it was SMA.
Got you, yeah.
Adult onset SMA.
Had you heard of SMA before? Was there any knowledge of any family history around SMA?
Nothing at all. No member of my family appears to have had this at all.
Yeah. I mean, as someone, I have type 2 SMA, and I imagine it's the genetics must be similar for you and I. Obviously, the parent both carry the gene, but it's then the two dominant genes are the SMA gene, and then that's what results in the child having different, yeah, obviously there's all the different types, and that's what we're talking about more recently, the sort of different types and some of those different experiences within it. But the more broader point of SMA is, it obviously does come within the family, but like you, I'm not aware of anybody in the family tree that actually had the condition. So it's, yeah, similar experience there that you and I have got. So in terms of, you never heard of it, so what kind of information support were you given once you'd received that diagnosis?
Very little, because the GPs know nothing about it either.
Mm.
So it was onto the internet. And it's very difficult to find anything on the internet. Well, it was at that time, to be honest.
Mm.
But I was moved on, if you like. I went for, I think it's called an EMG, which is when they stick needles in parts of your body to test the nerve signals.
Yeah.
I had that done at Stoke, and they were quite clear then that there's something amiss. The signals weren't going down properly.
Mm.
And then I was moved on to Queen Elizabeth in Birmingham.
Right.
Where I met a very good consultant called Professor Morrison.
Okay.
And she knew all about it.
She so in the end, it was a person, the consultant that had got that knowledge and experience to sort of maybe share a bit more what SMA was and what that might mean for you. But yeah, as you say, rather than the internet providing answers at that point, it was more that professional, yes.
And I also managed to find out about, then it was called the Jennifer Trust.
Yes, that's
right. But it's now renamed to, is it SMA?
UK. Yeah.
UK.org.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Over the intervening probably 15 years, they've now produced quite informative booklets about the different kinds of SMA.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's a place, if you've got it and don't know anything about it, that really is the place to go.
Yeah, because I know, sort of mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I've been working with some other community members that we've been doing some videos and they've been going out on social media. So I think there's probably a part around the evolution of the internet, sort of that, you know, there was things there, but it was hard to find it. And obviously at the very, very beginning, there probably wasn't really any information in general around these sort of topics. So there's been that provision of information thanks to the professionals and the charities. And then sort of gradually, I think, yeah, it's become more easy to find whatever it is we're looking for. It's just a general thought there about how the evolution of the internet's probably made it better and better over time. And you know, I remember, like you, the Jennifer Trust, that was how I first came into contact. I think my mum and dad you know, were sort of very engaged with the newsletters, and we used to go to the conference every couple of years when I was a child. And it was then nice to meet other people with the condition and obviously hear about the latest research and updates as well. So in terms of Jennifer Trust and now SMA UK, have you ever been to any of the actual conferences in person?
No, I haven't. I've only been to their headquarters.
Okay, yes, yeah, so you visited them in person. Yeah,
visited them in person. Yeah. But if you go on the internet, it's amazing how you can find mysterious and strange diseases.
Yeah,
that are really uncatalogued in a way.
Yeah,
all over the world, and it is a difficult place to get out of from that. You know, you could convince yourself you've got all sorts of things.
Well, I understand from, I take your point there, Peter, that I think whenever anyone feels a bit under par, so to speak, and they go to Google or whatever search engine they use and put in their sort of symptoms, it comes up with all sorts of horror, worst case scenarios. I think it's we have to balance the kind of the information's there to help if and when we need it, but not to become overly concerned that every time we feel a bit under par, it doesn't always have to be the worst case scenario, right?
And the NHS themselves have got pages on this, and it's greatly improved since when I first started with it.
The provision of SMA information has definitely been a lot better. So I think it'd be great to start, I suppose, to hear about your experiences of living with SMA, you know, day to day. Well, one thing I was actually just going to add was, I know that from the charity, you've been very helpful where there are sort of forums or, you know, people can ask questions, particularly with SMA type 4 onset. You've been really helpful of actually sharing, you know, different answers or experiences. So I know that you've, over the years, become a big contributor, which is, I know, very gratefully received by the charity and by the other members that have benefited from your time and effort in that. So big thank you for all your efforts there.
Right. Thank you.
But yeah, in terms of living day to day, I mean, obviously you mentioned the sort of having a limp and then not really being able to walk when you were around 50, and that day you were delivering the Christmas cards. So how sort of from that, those tests and from that diagnosis, how have things played out sort of soon after that and more up to now?
Well, I think the trouble really I've got is I could stand and walk in the year 2000, but it started to become obvious that I couldn't do it very well at all. And now, 20 years later, I can't really walk. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
I would never attempt to walk outside. I would go in a wheelchair. I can only make a few steps inside. So it has deteriorated that far. Though if you read the literature, they say many people don't end up in a wheelchair.
Right, yeah. Well, I know with me as a type 2, we're generally in a wheelchair from, you know, very young age, and always will be. But then, you know, there are type 2s that are more severe, almost borderline type 1, and then there's type 2s that it's milder, and they're almost type 3, and they were able to walk for a period of childhood like most type 3s were able to. So I think it's a sliding scale and it affects everyone differently, but as you say, it's sort of, yeah, within type 4, some can walk, you know, maybe with more difficulty, but can walk forever, and others like yourself, you know, it does become more and more difficult. But what sort of advice or hints or tips would you, or I'd say, have you given, because I know you've, has been touched upon before, you have given different types of help to people, but yeah, just sort of for this podcast, for the listeners, anyone that has maybe found out they've been diagnosed with type 4, or they're, you know, maybe had the diagnosis for a while, but just generally, what tips would you give them?
Yeah, well, Professor Morrison was very good at that time, actually. For instance, she suggested I go to the orthotics department. I mean, for people who don't know what that means, which they may not do, that's splints and things like that. So I've had ankle foot orthoses, they're called, which help stabilize the ankle.
Yeah.
Which is
that sounds familiar. I think I had them at some point as well, Pete.
That's great news for me, because it actually means that I have a vague idea where my feet are when I attempt to walk about.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you need to try, is get the orthotics. And the other thing is physiotherapy. She referred me to, well, I think it was physiotherapy at Telford. But of course, if you go to a hospital for physiotherapy, I think you only get 7 weeks, and they expect you to be recovered by then. You know, it's really for injury recovery.
I was going to say, it sounds like a different sort of patient, so to speak.
But, yeah. Yes, but she then referred me to what's called the Neuromuscular Centre.
Oh, yeah.
Which is in Winsford, in Cheshire. She thought it was in Oswestry, but it's not. It's in Winsford in Cheshire. And I used to go there every 2 weeks before lockdown, and have stretches and things like that. So really, I mean, it depends if you can get to a place like that. I don't know where there are any others, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm aware of one in Coventry that I've been to that does neuromuscular. But yeah, there's a handful, I believe, dotted around. And if anyone listening, you know, is in other parts of the country, I think Newcastle possibly has one. But
Newcastle. Yes.
Yeah, but obviously they can get in touch with SMA UK. As you said earlier, Peter, on the website, there's a lot of this sort of information. So just for anyone wondering where their local one is, definitely check out the SMA UK website. So you've touched upon orthotics and physio. So the sort of, I guess that's around the maintaining and helping the sort of physical side of health. I mean, so I want to touch upon the sort of mental well-being in a second, but in terms of the physical well-being, well, is there anything else to mention that you found either a challenge or to be proactively useful, or both?
You've got to keep warm.
Mm-hmm.
I must have the coldest legs in the world.
Well, so it sounds familiar. Yep.
You know, it's amazing how the rest of me, waist upwards, is quite warm.
Yeah.
But the legs, especially the lower part of the legs and the feet, become intensely cold.
Yeah.
And today it's frost and fog.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to make special care that I do keep warm. And this can be very difficult because I do not notice that I'm getting cold. I have no feelings whatsoever.
Yeah, definitely keeping warm. What about some other points around, you know, nutrition and rest? And I guess it's, in a way, it's the thing everybody with or without a disability has to keep an eye on. But have you found, for example, that sort of nutrition played a role more around having SMA type 4?
Well, I'm a vegetarian, which, you know, causes problems in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've got to be aware that having a good meal is probably the best thing you can do every day.
Yeah.
I mean, to get down to personal matters, being sat in a wheelchair or a chair, as I am, all day is not a good place to be.
Yeah.
I can't do any exercise. I do have type 2 diabetes, which I can't get rid of because I do it probably by exercise. So you've got to keep your body well, if you like, by what you put in it. And, for instance, I have vitamin D now, which really is recommended for virtually everybody, isn't it?
Yeah. But
because I don't go out that often, you know, I can't get the sunshine.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you about mobility. I mean, you mentioned a wheelchair. What sort of wheelchair is it? And how did you, you know, when you first realized or were told that you would need a wheelchair, how was that experience of actually getting your first wheelchair?
The very first one was rather difficult. I got it from the Shropshire Wheelchair Service.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, I bought my own. And I also, of course, was working at this time, and it was the Access to Work scheme.
Yep.
Bought me a power chair. So okay. I spent the final years of teaching in a power chair.
How was that for you, sort of that, you know, I don't, maybe you tell us how long it was from when you said you were 45 and, you know, you had that limp on your right leg to needing to use the wheelchair, and how, I was going to say about the mental health side as well, like how was that for you to adapt to life in that way?
Yeah, I think I really went in a wheelchair about 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So I had about 5 years when I used to use crutches and such like, but it became obvious that it was just too dangerous. Falling is a great fear, really. But mentally, it never affected me. I think I am quite unusual in that respect. I must be incredibly adaptable. Because obviously some people who end up in a wheelchair would, you know, literally go off their heads mentally and get totally depressed. But no, it never affected me.
And what about care-wise? I mean, do you have to have help from others for any of the sort of daily living tasks now?
Yes, my wife.
Okay, yeah.
She helps me when I need it.
Yeah, yeah. Because, again, sort of knowing it more from the type 2 perspective, but I always had to have my mum and dad. And then when I left home, I had personal care assistants at university. And when I lived in London, and then I'm now with my fiance, and so she does some, but we still have some of the personal care assistants coming in, and everyone, you know, whatever type, regardless of type, I think has different ways and routines and solutions. So just to clarify, you've never had a sort of outside person coming in, it's always been your wife that provided the care.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I only need help at certain times, like taking a shower.
Yeah.
I can get into the, it's in a bath, on the bath, the shower. So she helps me get in, but I essentially have the shower myself. Mm. And basic things like going to the toilet, she will help me to the toilet, but not more than that.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Really, it's when I'm out and about, that's when you need the help. All pavements seem very wobbly to me.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the, there's the at home, you know, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, how that's enabling you to be as independent as possible. And as you say, your wife supports you when you do need a hand from someone else. And then, yeah, the kind of out and about, it's as much about the physical environment of, is there ramps and wheelchair yeah. access can be the other challenge, right?
Yeah. But I have all sorts of things to help me, like grabbers, which mm-hmm. are usually for old people. But if you drop something on the floor and you can't reach it, then a grabber is very helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
But I adapted to all of this quite happily. It's just part of my life, so to speak.
Yeah, he's definitely got that. You sound a very positive person. And you say, like, yeah. wherever there's a challenge, you've just gone and found a workaround yeah. and found a solution, right?
Yeah, that's it.
How about, have you ever had any pain relating to SMA type 4?
Constant.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I have. Well, it depends whether you call it pain. Very rarely do I get, if you like, acute pain.
Mm.
But constantly, from the minute I wake up to the minute I go to bed, there's an ache in the feet, ankles, and lower legs.
Mm-hmm.
I expressed it a long time ago. It's like being in tight Wellingtons or something like that.
Okay.
You feel as though there's this sensation around your feet and legs.
Yeah.
But if I, you know, it's very easy to damage my toes. Yeah. I try and avoid them touching anything at all because it would be painful.
Yeah. So it's partly a sort of achiness, but also just a almost a concern as to causing pain or injury as well. So sort of,
yeah.
Yeah. To avoid it, which is obviously a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then so we're sort of moving towards the end of our chat, but a couple more things I was going to ask yeah. you. I've obviously mentioned physiotherapy, but have you ever done any other therapy, sort of holistic or, you know, other yeah. types?
Yes, at the neuromuscular center, they used to do acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
which they thought might help with the pain relief. And I think it did for a bit, but of course, with lockdown, it's all collapsed. You know, they're not running the usual things anymore.
Mm.
But I thought that acupuncture was quite good. And meditation, really basically trying to just, you know, relax all the time. And
mm.
if necessary, go to bed.
Yeah.
I mean, at the beginning, I became very, very exhausted. Just had to go to bed and sleep.
Yeah. Do you think that was partly because you were having to use a lot more energy sort of prior to being in the wheelchair as well?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, well, unless there's anything else you wanted to sort of mention in terms of your general experiences and things. I think my last question is just for someone that's maybe being newly diagnosed. I think it's quite likely this podcast would be found by someone that, you know, either the person themselves or a family or friend of someone that's being diagnosed. So just final thoughts on what you would tell them at that point and maybe where they can find additional and other information as well.
Yes, I would certainly recommend the smauk.org site. That's the best place, you know, to get information.
Yeah.
You probably won't get it from your GP. they're just not trained to deal with this sort of problem. And you've got to keep your mental health up. You can't get depressed, because once you stop moving around and doing nothing, it just gets worse.
Mm. And I guess that's, everyone's going to have their own journey and find their own ways. But like for you, when there were those challenges and those adjustments to life, was there anything you look back on that you think you did, even if it was a bit sort of subconscious at the time, but, just in terms of staying positive and keeping moving forward, are there any ways that you went about that from the psychological perspective?
Well, I ended up eventually in IT, and I've been using computers probably for over 20 years.
Mm.
And that is my, my eye to the world.
Yeah.
I can get what I need from the computer.
Mm.
But if you're a very practical person, I mean, at the time I thought, what would happen if I was a bus driver? Well, I would have lost my job.
Mm.
I couldn't have I have an automatic adapted car. So there are many jobs where you will lose your job. And that's quite frightening.
Yeah, I guess in that instance, someone would have to, retrain and look to do a different job. But as you say, for you, that wasn't the case. You were able to continue your profession, which was,
yes.
I guess, relative, obviously having to deal with a lot of other difficulties, but relatively what was a positive of that side. But no, I think you're right. It's generally about, just sort of finding that passion and interest, isn't it? And being able to still do that regardless of some of the physical limitations that happen.
And also the disease may not follow my route. You may just end up with a limp.
Yeah.
Which essentially was what I thought would happen right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, it'll just be limping about from place to place, but it turned out differently.
Yeah.
But for someone else, it could be completely different.
Yeah, they say the SMA, the effect SMA has the life and then the sort of variables, if you like, of a person's job and how it affects them. All of those are variables. Everyone's going to have a different experience. But it was very, very useful and interesting to hear your story, Peter, and really appreciate you taking the time and being so open and sharing on the podcast and obviously, as we mentioned, in the forums as well. Was there any other things you want to mention before we wrap?
No, I can't think of anything else. No.
Great. All right. Well, everyone, I hope you've enjoyed today's show. And if you have any other questions, get in touch with SMA UK. And if they are for Peter, I'm sure the charity can send them on to Peter as well. So don't feel that this is the last you need to sort of hear on this topic or from Peter as well. But for today, that's the end of the podcast. And yeah, Peter, thank you very much again.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Living with SMA podcast. We hope you can join us again next time. But in the meantime, please don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find out more on our website at smauk.org.uk.